But the goal of my talk would be mainly advertising. What I would like to advertise is a class of problems that, in my opinion, is not enough addressed in the field, and I think is more and more important for neuroimaging. What I have in mind is the inference impact of structural models of the brain organization. And here, when I use the word structural, I mean a graph-based model, different models aiming at splitting the brain into smaller entities. To be maybe a bit clearer, if you remember the very nice talk we had yesterday about the bottom lines of the folding patterns, the idea is that if you do that for 1,000 brains, how do we infer a model of that? A graph-based model, maybe a random graph, something. How can we deal with that? And I don't have any solution for that. So I will just give you ideas about all the instances of this kind of problems you will find in neuroimaging. And I hope that there will be people here fitting some background with this kind of problems. My talk will focus on anatomical imaging. But some of my colleagues could give the same talk dealing with functional images. It's very, very similar situation. So first, I apologize because of course, this talk will not be as formal as a talk on pure shape based, for instance, on invariance to some group of transformation. Because you can imagine that when you deal with graph or this kind of stuff with natural shape, everything is a bit fuzzy. So once again, I apologize. I just hope I will let you some message back home, maybe the will to work more on brain problems. And the first thing we need when we want to define a model is to choose between two approaches. One that has been very, very successful in the field, which is based on coordinate system. It was something that was difficult to do 100 years ago when Darcy Thompson was doing this nice job. But now with the computer, this is so straightforward and this is so everywhere in the success of the neuroimaging community. I will not say a lot about that. But there is another approach that was maybe more intuitive for anatomists, which is, okay, I know there is a specific structure in the brain and I would like to perform some measurement on this structure to see if maybe it's modifying some disease. Once again, this is a very fuzzy way to define a model. We don't know exactly what the neuroanatomist has in mind. But as long as he can draw these structures in images, you can define some models. And of course, the modern grasp of that is all the template-based models to segment, for instance, hippocampus. This will not be the subject of my talk. My talk will be on objects that are so complex, you cannot deal with this kind of approach based, I don't know, on spherical harmonics. I have in mind, for instance, the folding patterns that you have to split into pieces to model, or the white matter made up of bundle, or the cortical surface made up of architectonic areas, this kind of thing. So, once again, this is the mainstream. 95% of the work in neuroimaging is based on coordinate system. There was great success behind that. And I will just show you that there are a few issues that you cannot address with this approach. Why? Because, and this is something relatively new for the people in the world of neuroscience that used to work, for instance, with great monkey. If you see these two mice-like brains, their cortex are fold about the same. So if you think about, for instance, warping one brain to the other one, it seems a relatively well-posed problem. In fact, it's much more complicated than that because it's not even sure that you have to fit the folds, because what you have to fit is architectures. And there's no claim that any of these folds is a strict landmark relative to architecture. But anyway, when you try to align the brains and you deal with human brains, the situation is not this one. The situation is this one. For instance, if you see this brain, which is coming from a famous French atlas, the atlas of Duvernoy, there is here in red the superior temporal sulcus, which is one of the main furrow crossing the brain. And if you try to find this sulcus in this second brain, you don't know where it is. So the point here is that in the old time, in the 19th century, there were some anatomists dealing with brain in water or formal and trying to propose some model of this stuff. They did the best job they could, but the models they proposed are not sufficient to deal with this variability. So what I have in mind is that I think that our community has a great opportunity to provide some new way to model the brain that maybe the people that are still neuroscientists cannot address. And before going further into that direction, I would like to claim that this structural paradigm, what maybe some people would call structuralism, is a very philosophical approach. This is something that is really related to the human brain, the human mind, the way we look at complex problems. We always want to split them in smaller things, and very often we do mistakes because of that. We push the stuff too far. But we have to do it. If we want to organize the to understand the organization of the brain, which is such a huge network, we have to find some structures in there. But we have to keep in mind that we often find structures everywhere and some structures that mean absolutely nothing. I'm sure everybody has some opinion about what is there. I think there's nothing there. And if you go back to all the history of neural anatomy, there's something that everybody will see something different.
Well, the company doesn't exist anymore. That was Lucent Technologies.
Really?
In that sense, there's nothing there. Oh, it's part of Alcatel that we call that.
So, for instance, if you look at the microscopic anatomy of the brain that used to be split into five or six lobes, some of the boundaries between these lobes are just imaginary lines. For instance, here there is a line between temporal and parietal lobe. It just means nothing. And some neuroscientists will claim, finally, maybe parietal and temporal lobe is the same entity in the brain. There's no reason to split the stuff here. If you look at something even more important for neuroscientists, which is Brodmann areas, what is called cytoarchitectonic areas, which are defined according to differences in the different kind of neurons you find in the brain, you have here a kind of a Krebs parcellation of the cortical surface. But if you look, for instance, in the parietal part behind the central sulcus, which is supposed to be the boundary of motor areas, you will find motor neurons. So it means that there's no Krebs boundaries everywhere between these different entities in the brain. So when you think structurally, you do all kind of mistakes, all kind of approximation, and you have to be aware of that. When you think about the brain in terms of cognitive science, there was a famous mistake in the old time, which is phrenology, you know. They split the brain into different entities based on stupid stuff. I will not comment on that. Some people may think we are still doing the same, but now the world is completely different. We have a connectionist approach. Whatever high-level behavior we are studying, we split it in a lot of entities. Each entity has a specific role, and they communicate different representations. But once again, this is the structural approach there. And anatomy or architecture and functions is exactly the same point, because of course the first constraint you have to deal with when you want to understand the organization, the cognitive organization of the brain, is the architecture. If your model does not fit architectures, it's nonsense. If you look, for instance, at this standard model of the visual system of macaque, you have all kinds of entities there. Most of them have a specific architectural property. The first level of splitting of the brain is related to the cytoarchitectomy, but for instance, if you take one Brodmann area, you find inside a lot of other smaller areas, because in fact the main way to define a part of the brain is connectivity. And this is what has been done with animals. What is really defining the role of a part of the brain is the way it communicates with all other parts of the brain. So there's a big revolution, in fact, I think, in brain science, because up to now we did not know the organization of the connectivity of the human brain. And with diffusion imaging, there's a great hope that things will change. You see this kind of images on managed nowadays. Maybe they are not yet very, very reliable, but maybe we will have access very soon to the organization of the connectivity of the cortex, which means we will be maybe able to split the cortex into elementary architectural areas, which will completely change the way we will analyze it later. And once again, here, we know nothing about this stuff, so we have to find a way to create models of the organization of all these fiber elements. And here, it's kind of a summary of this structural vision that I have about what could be done in neuroimaging if we were taking the structural paradigm to develop our methods. And I don't think we have to put under the carpet all the methods that are based on warping, but I think there is a complementary approach there that is mandatory to overcome some of the difficulties I mentioned. So I would say that there are three parts here. The first part is that we get some images from our scanners, and we have to convert these images into higher level representations that are dedicated to the part of the brain we want to study. And so if we want to study the cortical folding patterns, we have to do something corresponding to what has been presented yesterday. If you want to study the white matter, you have to extract track, or let's say fiber trajectory, organize them into a group of fibers making up a bundle, and so on. If you want to study the functional images, you have to find in the data some clusters of activated voxels that are supposed to correspond to some of these entities I'm talking about in terms of architecture. Once this is done, you forget about image world and you go to a kind of graph-based representation. You have to fit this graph with the current knowledge, which means you have to recognize the main furrows, you have to recognize the main bundle, you have to identify the very standard activation, like, I don't know, V1, V2, this kind of stuff. And the last part is trying to improve the model. For instance, going to see if close to V2 or V3 in the visual system, there's not a new array that is doing something special that you can align across people because you're really close to architecture. Or maybe if you are dealing with, let's say, fiber domain of the brain where we almost know, you have to infer a whole model of this organization. So this is three steps of the structural vision. And when I'm discussing with my colleagues, neuroscientists, and I want to be a bit provocative, I tell them my research program is to do artificial neuroscientists. Of course, this is not really the point. My goal is to do a kind of assistant for neuroscientists. I will never have a computer defining the experiment. But my point is that, unfortunately, nature did not give us a nice way to analyze these dense images of the brain, because we are doing stereo vision. And when you do stereo vision, what you can do when you look at this complicated data is either look at the slices on the wall, or use some software to do some kind of rendering of the brain shapes, but what you see is just 2D images. So we have a big disadvantage compared to the computer, because when you do computer vision, you can choose completely the architecture of your system. And for instance, you can base the system on a retina that is three-dimensional. And you can even give to the system as many retina as you want if you want to compare 1,000 brains at the same time. I don't know if some of you have tried to compare brains just visually on the screen. You look at one of the brain, after at the second one, and you overload your working memory, and you're just dead, and you don't go very far. The computer doesn't have this problem. And the other very important idea behind this stuff is that if you go to graph-based representation that are much closer to what you want to study than the voxels that are just related to the acquisition, you have much more chance to develop the right algorithm. And finally, why we believe we can do this kind of stuff? Just because this is a niche. We don't want to do a robot that can play around in UCLA campus. We just want to do a kind of vision system dedicated to this kind of images, so we know what is inside the images. So now, during most of my talk, I will focus on the cortical folding pattern, not because this is the most important problem, I would say because this is the one I'm working on for 15 years, and I know the best. And the last part of the talk will be to show you the generosity of all these ideas I will talk about. So here you see three brains. Maybe you've never done that. I'll let you have a look a few seconds on these brains. They are very standard. One of them is mine. The two other ones are some of my colleagues. And I don't know if you realize how different they are. So maybe some of you have seen in Atlas one model of the cortical folding pattern. Usually what people provide you is one brain with some ladders, and if you take another brain, you just cannot do it. Of course, there's some similarities, but this is very, very complicated, very, very disturbing. And there's no model of that. Nobody has never explained that. So there are some hypotheses, very interesting one. For instance, this idea of Van Essen, that what is driving, in fact, the cortical folding process, the dynamic of this process, is related to the tension stemming from the fiber of the embryo. 6 months in utero, the cortex is a sphere, not folded. And suddenly, in 3 months, everything happens very, very fast. It's a kind of phase transition. And what happens, in my opinion, is that all the balance between all the constraints stemming, for instance, from the bundles and other growing constraints, all this stuff is chaotic. So you kind of stop two brains very, very similar, but just because, for instance, it's different in the timing of arrival of some of axon that are developing some areas, you will have slight difference leading to different folding patterns. So with this point of view in mind, you would say that if I was reasonable, there's no hope. If it's chaotic, we'll never understand anything. But in fact, there's enough similarities there to hope that we will understand something. And there's two, in fact, goals. One of the goals is to try to find the link between this pattern and architecture, because what is interesting is architecture. The second goal is that maybe because this happened very early during brain growth, there could be in this folding pattern the signature of soft developmental diseases. So we are looking for new way to maybe diagnose very early some diseases like maybe autism or this kind of thing. So if you remember the general scheme of this structural vision, the first stage was to convert images in graph-based representation. The second one is to fit this graph-based representation with a model, which just means doing pattern recognition, for instance, identifying the standard circuit of the nomenclatures in any of these brains. So here you have the standard nomenclature, and you see the problem with it. It's one of my colleagues, a neuroanatomist and also neurosurgeon. Neurosurgeons are the few ones who are really interested in that, at least in the old time. And he put the colors on these brands corresponding, according to him, to the standard nomenclature. Somebody else will do something different, but it's the best we can do up to now. There's a lot of people in UCLA doing this kind of stuff. They know what I have in mind when I say it's very difficult. So the first stuff we did, in a way to convince our colleagues that there was some space there for people doing computer vision, is to develop a system doing the same automatically. And because there was already such a nice talk yesterday afternoon explaining you the kind of algorithms that are required to convert images in graphical representation, mm-hmm. I will not describe that at all. I will just give you a few ideas about how it works, but just with analogy with the current vision of the biological vision system. So the first thing that this system is doing when it gets an image from the scanner is to align it with the standard grid. And this is very similar to what you do when you read a book. You don't read a book like that, you read a book like that. So you just align the brain with the standard system, which is, in fact, is the 3D retina of the artificial vision system. And after that, you have a bottom-up stream of processing. The first levels of processing are very local. They are something like edge detection. And little by little, you expand the field of view of the processing unit. So at the beginning, you just compute edges of the brain, internal edges of the cortex. And after that, you want to know where are the faults. So this is something like a skeleton, a negative mold of the brain. And there, to know that you're in a fault, you need to see that there's a wall on your right side and a wall on your left side. So this is a method. All the methods here are based on mathematical morphology, topology preserving deformations, homotopic pruning, skeletonization. It's not important. The important stuff is to understand that we are converting images into graphs. After that, once you have this kind of negative mold of the brain, which is made up of very complicated pieces of surfaces, you split this skeleton into pieces using simple topological information. Let's imagine that my two hands are folds of the brain and that they stick together like that. And you consider all the points that are separating the background into two connected components. It's a bit like if you put two magnets on both sides of my hand, and you can slide the magnets and you will get a kind of key balance class, which would be what we call simple surface. And you cannot slide the magnet from one hand to the other hand, so you will separate the two hands. So you get all kind of pieces there, which are very elementary folds. And the last part, which is the pattern recognition part, is to reconstruct from these pieces the usual circuit of the nomenclature. So before reaching that last part, which is maybe something that is happening in the temporal lobe in humans, just to give you more information about what are the graphs behind this stuff, here you see only one sulcus that is made up of a lot of elementary folds. Each color is a fold. Each square box is one of the nodes of the graph. And each circle, in fact, is a link between these boxes, representing, for instance, the fact that two of these folds touch each other, or the fact that two folds are parallel in the brain, and this kind of stuff. And what happened here is that, according to the brain, one given sulcus of the nomenclature corresponds to a very different subgraph of the whole graph, representing the whole brain, which is made up about 300, 400 nodes. And according to the models you have, either you will say, okay, this subgraph here is the superior frontal sulcus that can be connected or split into pieces. And if you have more sophisticated models like the one I will talk about later, you will say, no, in fact, there's three different entities in this subgraph, which are these three colors here, that I will call later sucralose. So another way, once again, to think about this stuff is that you have a graph to represent one geometry, one brain, and you want to match it with a model that is another graph that if I was going into mathematics, I would formalize like a random graph, but I will not do that today. But you just want to match these two graphs. So it's a kind of one-to-many matching between these two graphs. So you just take each of the entities of the model, and you will find a couple of nodes representing these entities. And another thing that is important in this model is the link between entities, because two circles that are close or neighbor in the brain will define some specific pattern recognition system. So for each of these entities of the model graph, there will be an elementary pattern recognition unit that can be, for instance, a multilayer perceptron that will be trained to recognize this feature in any brain. And for each pair, in fact, of entities, for instance, the central sulcus, the big one in red here, and the precentral sulcus in yellow, there will be another pattern recognition entity, another perceptron, that will in fact recognize, be trying to recognize the shape made up by these two circles. So at the end, you will have about 500 of these elementary units that will collaborate to perform the whole recognition. And it means that if you want, for instance, to recognize one circus, you will need to share the opinion of a lot of these small entities. And in fact, they are gathered together in a Gibbs field. So they are trained on the database where the folds have been labeled manually. Another thing that is learned from this database is that for each of these entities, there is a restricted portion of the space where you can find, in fact, the underlying circus. This is the reason why everything is cast in a Gibbs field framework, because all the a priori knowledge that is learned from the database is local. So there's only local interaction between the nodes. And once you have trained, yeah?
Is your graph keeping geometric properties or only topological properties? So you keep like how curvy one of the sultai or the panda is, how long, there's attributes in the graph?
Yeah, everything is based on attributes and topology too, for instance, the number of connected components according to various wave configuration, this kind of stuff, yeah.
So have you ever tried to do deep sampling from those graphs to generate sultai to see how they move?
We don't do it that way. It's something we never try to do. It's a bit, we not manage to do it, at least with this kind of model. This is really developed for recognition in other way. It's not generative at all. Yeah, maybe I should insist a bit. Each of these material perception is fed with a very simple stuff that is a kind of summary of some attributes describing a subgraph corresponding to one given label. This can be simple stuff like the size of all the total size of the folds or the orientation in a Tellurac framework. More sophisticated stuff like the invariance of coordinates moments, or connectivity property like the number of components, this kind of stuff. And now we have to plug some feature selection system because we are using more and more attributes, so we reach the curse of dimensionality problem. So I finish with that. And now I will show you a little movie to show you what happens when you take a new brain that is going through the bottom-up stream of processing, and after that present it to this community of perception. So in fact, basically, we just minimize the kind of energy. I will show you a movie where, at the beginning, of course, the labels are put randomly. And I put a color code here that corresponds to the local energy of the system everywhere. At the beginning, of course, the labels are random, so energy is high, and you will see the evolution. And what is interesting in this movie is that there is a kind of phase transition again that is really corresponding to what standard anatomists are doing. You see here, this is the central sulcus. This is the most stable place in the brain. And this is the first stuff that is recognized. It's a bit like when you have frozen water beginning where there's some little stuff. It's funny because this was not coding the system, but most of the brains, this happened like that.
I don't understand what you're looking at, so I'm sorry. You've been talking for a while, I think, so I want to try to understand what you just showed us. So you're annealing. What's the range space of the random, you get this random process, it's annealing, the temperature's changing, so it's moving towards its extreme point. What are the values of this random process?
Okay. Each of the nodes of the graph corresponding to this random can vary among a number of ladders that correspond to sulci. Sorry. And in fact, if you see here, this is the variability of the location of each of the sulci in the parallel framework. It's giving a kind of bounding box. So it means that if you have one node for one grain somewhere here, you can see what are the possible levels. So it will be the state space for this.
Okay, problem. So it's a color value process. So
yeah,
color is the label that corresponds.
Yeah, it's a kind of Potts
model. And for that geometry, so if we go back
to
the picture, for that geometry, you've manually put in each of those values, you've put a whole bunch of colors. It's one set of labels, or you have, in a sulcus valley, you have 100 different possible labels, and we just, so the annealing of those 100 values, another 100 values, another 100 values.
It's that except that usually it's 10 values, not 100.
Otherwise, okay, so it's one in each deep region?
Well, each node has a specific list of values.
But a node, at a sulcus, so you know, I'm not a sultist, I'm a sultist. So I have this random process that's going to go, it's going to move, and a node is I put a collar that is over the whole sulcus, one collar. And I ask the random field, is it singlet sulcus? Is it something else? Is it central? Is that what I'm looking at? And the collar that I see.
Yeah, the collars are the central sulcus, superfrontal sulcus.
It's the names.
Yeah, the names.
So how many total? How many possible label values are there?
There's about 50, 60 labels in each hemisphere.
Okay. So, and then the attribute values, where the information is being collected in the Gibbs model, is back somewhere. You know, how does the geometry that I'm looking at? You know, so this is sitting on this particular geometry, right? It's only this geometry. How does that information get put in as the conditioning information in this probability?
I wasn't going to spend too much time on that. The idea is that if you take one labeling, one random labeling somewhere during the annealing, you take one of these colors. This color, in fact, corresponds to, for this current labeling, the identification of one circuit. And in fact, this subgraph corresponding to the circuit is embedded in the bounding box corresponding to the circuit, which is the kind of type of the underlying Markov field. So from this graph, you can infer some attributes, the kind of stuff I was talking about before, number of connected components, size, orientation, interact. And with this coding, the network that has been trained before will give you a value that is zero if it's close to the shapes that have been teached, and one if it's not. And the way that we train them is that we have the good example here, and we modify randomly this example to create the counter example. Okay.
Could you say just something about the degeneracy, as you can say, from an eigenvalue point of view? How many different ways can you do this? How much of it is arbitrary, or how unique is the way you're doing this?
I would say that this system is just a system mimicking my friend doing neural anatomy. If some of you want to do something else, we'll have another system, because there's no gold standard. This is the reason why I need people to work on trying to find a model of this stuff, because everybody has a different view of how to label these faults. Okay? So we just have a generic way here to mimic the labeling somebody will do. So why is it useful? I will spend a few time showing you a few applications of that. Everybody here has heard about voxel-based morphometry and deformation-based morphometry. Here you can do just the same, where rather than comparing people voxel by voxel, you can compare them circuit by circuit. So you just use this system that is completely automatic, you extract the fold, you recognize them, and after you measure some stuff fold by fold. And of course you can do it with the dual representation, which is the gyri. We have some way to go from the circuit to the gyri. And I will show you a very simple example. In fact, because of the few stuff I was talking about, the fact that we use discrete topology to define these folds, we have all kinds of ways, for example, to get the bottom points, points that correspond to the junction between the fold and the end of the brain, the stemming from a closing. And so you can compute things like depth, length, surface. This is the first descriptor you can use to compare subjects. And we did an experiment on the database that is the ICBM database that has been acquired in the MNI in Montreal, because there was a paper using voxel-based morphometry to address maybe one of the simplest questions when you think there is some stress of neuroscience in anatomy. The idea that there are some places that are bigger in some population because maybe there are more neurons or more synapses. And here it's comparing left-handed people with right-handed people. So it was a standard database maybe of a student of McGill with 10% of left-handed people. So we use the system. What you see here in 3D, it's maybe 14 left-handed people and 14 right-handed people put in direct framework, so with the automatic recognition. And for each of the circuits, we compute a very simple index of asymmetry, which is the ratio between size on the left, size on the right, normalized by the sum. And I took a brain randomly, and for each of the population, I plot here the median of this ratio in each population. So if the color is in the blue tint, it means that the circuit is bigger in the right hemisphere. If it's in the left, it's bigger in the left hemisphere. And of course, the guess is that we will find something in the motor areas, and nothing has been found using voxel-based morphometry based on affine normalization. And here you see a lot of asymmetry. If you remember the talk yesterday of Monica, of course, there's a lot of asymmetry in the folding pattern, so you can distinguish a fold from the left hemisphere to the right hemisphere for sure. You see a lot of similarities between the two populations in the colors, but there are a few places where it's not the same. And for instance, if you look at the central sulcus here, which is hosting the primary motor system, it's yellow in the right-handed people, which means it's bigger in the left hemisphere. And it's blue for left-handed people, so bigger in the right hemisphere. And it was the initial guess. If you think, in fact, that the motor system is bigger in the dominant hemisphere, so there may be all kind of explanation. Either the motor system is bigger, so it takes more space, so the brain is pushed to fold further. Or maybe the axons are bigger, more myelin. They are pulling further, so the fold is pulled in the depth of the brain. We don't know, but there's a difference. So it's just to show that when you deal with this structural representation, you have access to other way to compare the morphometry of the brains.
What's the variability? You say it's bigger for this, but what's the internal variability between the left-handed or the right-handed?
Sorry?
Is the difference that you find between the left and right-handed, what's that relation with the internal variability that you find inside the left-handed? Maybe that difference is very small compared to the...
In fact, the p-value is about 0.02. It's not a very strong effect because there's a lot of variability, but this is significant because we have a priori. In fact, if you were doing correction for multiple testing because there's 50 sulcus, you would lose the significant. But the fact that we are in the model system makes us relatively confident.
And have you tried to check, you know, since you have this tool, can you try to check which one of the sulci is the most stable across? I mean, you have all the tools just to go and pick, you know, five popular, six popular sulci and say which one is the more stable according to your instruments.
My problem is that I don't have enough time, but I have to make some comments. All this stuff is not perfect. There's still a lot of trouble. The training asset is maybe only 30 grand, which is not enough to learn variability. I'm just describing a framework. I'm not claiming that this is the end of the story. This is the reason why we have to infer a new model. So the experiment you propose is very interesting, but we decided we don't do this kind of stuff because we know our system is not finished. For instance, we have to deal with feature selection, we have to increase the learning database, and we have to improve the model. So, of course, you can play about the variability, the kind of stuff Paul did in the old time to see what are the most stable sulcus. There's so many things that can be done that we did the effort to push this to the community, so somebody interested can play with that. But I'm not doing that myself, I don't have time. So, of course, we try to understand why the people in the MNI, Piquet Watkins, in fact, did not find any significant result. Which is not so surprising, considering that, of course, this is not a strong, strong result. It's maybe a 5% difference in the size of the sulcus. And we just took the 14 left-handed people and put them in 3D, the motor system in 3D with match right-handed people, match in terms of sex and age. And what you see is that, in fact, central sulcus is in the back, 5 millimeter back. So it could explain that with affine normalization, you have a trouble. This could be overcome maybe with nonlinear normalization, but this has to be proved. Because of course, yes, just try to explain the kind of trouble you have with the approach based on warping. You don't have a complete control of what's happening. If you imagine that my hand is a simple model of the brain with a 5 gyrus, and you have another hand like that, you have to warp to it. If at the beginning the finger cross, it shows up. If you have a very strong regularization, you will never go out of that. And if you have something not very regularized, some kind of diffeomorphism, very, very relaxed, and the fingers are not aligned correctly, you will morph the little finger to the ring finger, and this kind of stuff. And you can do very nice morphing, very good in Hollywood, but nothing to do with neuroscience. So this is very, very complicated. When you remember the kind of variability I've shown you with the faults, you can imagine that when you do nonlinear warping, this is very difficult to forecast what happens. What I think the hope for the approach based on diffeomorphism is if you, rather than taking one template, take 100. And here, everything is different. Maybe the solution is in there. It's expensive, but maybe if you have 100 different models, you will manage to deal with this variability, but this has to be proven. Another example, what the previous example was showing that you can lose some information because of the problem of alignment that you recover if you use structural representation. You can also create a spurious result. I choose this result because it's something that may interest people here. It's a genetic disease leading to people that are very bad in math. And using the standard voxel-based approach, it was found that there's difference in terms of amount of gravity in the parietal lobe, which kind of fit with the a priori about the DCS because this is the place dealing with spatial transformation and this kind of thing. And playing with the Sukai, it was fun, for instance, that the big fissure in the parietal lobe is not as deep for the patient. But there was something very disturbing in the neuroscientists, is that with the voxel-based morphometry, they found a difference in the central sulcus, in the motor system, which could not be interpreted. And what happened is that because of the atrophy of the parietal lobe, once again, normalization was not giving the same for the two populations. And the central sulcus of the patients was much behind the one of the standard subject, leading to these artifacts in voxel-based morphometry. Once again, nonlinear deformation could solve this problem. And this is the reason why people like Paul and this experiment done within RIA is trying to inject some constraint to try to create a less ill-posed problem when you normalize. For instance, if you have a strong method, a robust that can identify your faults, like the central sulcus, you can inject that as a constraint of the normalization. Here, it's once again to explain you the same kind of stuff as with the finger. It's 5 grain, where the central sulcus in red has been identified automatically. And after linear transformation, one of the fold is stuck behind because the brain maybe is a bit different, or maybe the normalization does not get the same. And if you do standard nonlinear warping, nothing is changing because central sulcus is in the post-central sulcus. Gray on gray, everybody's happy. Nothing is moving. If you add a constraint, you overcome this problem. Another kind of result, maybe much more impressive for people who are interested in neuroscience. Maybe you heard that during the last years there was some result tending at proving that autism could be related to the brain. Of course, there's a lot of talking about this kind of stuff. But there was, for instance, a functional experiment showing that autistic kids have some trouble in perceiving language, this kind of stuff. And here, we did an experiment in the same area, once again, with some a priori. We tried to compare the size of the superior temporal sulcus, which is bordering all these areas implied in maybe some problem for autistic kids. And we found, in fact, that the clinical estimation of the degree of autism is correlated with the size of the sulcus, which could be interpreted that this area is not developing correctly in some of these kids, and the pressure on folding is not as important, and this is correlated to the degree of the disease. Another kind of application that is a bit more complicated, but which is at the origin of my implication in this field, so I will just give you an example. The idea is that in some epilepsy surgery, very complex one, the one that puts them from frontal lobe, that usually are not taken in charge, for instance, in North America, it's too complicated, too expensive. Some crazy people in France try to deal with this patient, and they mix all kinds of experiments to try to guess where the seizure is coming from. And in fact, the guy working with me on anatomy is a neurosurgeon involved in that, and working with brains years after years, he realized that these people had some abnormal folding pattern. So if you remember all my stories to recognize the folds, if we apply this stuff to a patient and we keep the local energy, there are some places where the local energy stay high because whatever long is the annealing process, there's no pattern fitting with the learning database. And here it's an example where this patient, there was a place here that stayed red, high energy, something was not standard according to our database. I will not say not normal because I don't know what is normality. And this stuff was not used to do the surgery. There was a deaf electrode implantation, all kind of recording. And finally, they decided to remove this area. The patient was cured. And it turns out that this fold is really too deep. It's not standard, even for me now, after years and years working with anatomy. So this is another kind of application of this stuff. And I'm not sure that doing the standard warping-based approach, it's very easy to infer this kind of result.
Didn't they used to just cut the hemispheres from each other as a way to deal with epileptics, in which case we know it has something to do with crossing the center?
But this is not the approach. Here, the approach is really to remove a part of the cortex. Another kind of application. When you want to perform multi-center experiment, you go into a big mess because each machine is giving a different kind of noise. Each clinician is tuning his machine differently in terms of thickness. And when you think even in terms of Shannon theory, when you want to estimate the thickness of the cortex, which is 2-3 millimeters with images that are 1-2 millimeter resolution, there's a big problem. It could be that measuring, in fact, the shape of this fold is another way to think about that. Because when the brain is getting atrophic, the folds are opening because there's less space occupied by tissue. And in fact, the fold is also getting more shallow. And here, in fact, you see the kind of tendency you have with age. Unfortunately, as early as 20s, 30s, our folds are opening. And it could be that it's easier to measure the opening of the folds because this is the contrast between tissue and CSF than to measure the thickness, because there could be some link between T1 and T2 contrast and age. And so there could be some interesting application there to do multi-center studies. And now we'll go to where I think we need a lot of people working, how to infer models, because the only thing I did to know is show you a system that is trying to mimic, to find the standard model, but just say that this model is no good, so we need better model. I just say I will not talk about functional imaging, I just will use one slide to show you that functional imaging is the same, it's exactly the same problematic. You have an experiment, you do some SPM, where in each voxel you have a kind of answer to the experiment, and you want to compare the people. And they are not perfectly aligned, this brain. So if you want at a voxel-based level, you don't know exactly what happened. But if you do, you add this in the first stage, which is getting into a graph-based representation, here what is done is that we use a standard heat equation to construct a scale space. And in fact, that way we get a representation of all the hills that are in these clusters. After that, you can develop some graph matching process to find some hills that are about at the same place in Tyrak, but not exactly. And that could be, in fact, the same entity. I will not say more, but it's just to show you that this is a really general way of thinking about this. And now, what to do to find a better model of the folding patterns? I'm talking about the folding patterns for too long, so I will talk about chairs now, because most of you know what is a chair. Maybe you will understand better that problem. So, for a long time, I think there are some people everywhere in the world trying to teach robots what is a chair. I don't know if I've reached that goal because I'm not working in this field. I'm not sure at all. Because chair is something that is very intuitive for us. But if we imagine that the main problem for them is that they have to deal with stereo vision. It's very complicated. But let's imagine we are in another world where the robot has a scanner. He can do a 3D dense acquisition of the chairs. And after that, he can develop methods a bit like the ones that we proposed yesterday afternoon to split the chairs into pieces and get the kind of graph-based representation of the topology of the chair. Would there be a way to create a grammar creating all the possible shape of chair we see here? Maybe there are some clever people that could manage to find a grammar giving that using notions like the foot, the place where you sit, but it's very difficult. I think the main reason why for each of us, it's very easy to know if it's a chair, it's just we feel we can sit in this stuff and it's okay, it's a chair. And maybe somebody here has a very bright idea of grammar, so he should see if it's working with these chairs. Could you imagine that there was some chair not touching the ground? Maybe it's not a chair, of course. Very fast with this kind of stuff, you go into philosophical issue of what is a category, what is it a chair or not a chair. But when you are dealing with the brain, you get into this stuff all the time. Why did the old anatomist decide that this is a sulcus and we give it a name? There could be all kind of very interesting cognitive science behind or information theory. It's not clear at all. And when, unfortunately, you follow people like me and you go into this structural framework, you go into the problem of how do I choose the right representation? Do I choose the bottom line of folds, collectors? Nobody knows what's the right one. What is sure is that as long as your approach is bottom-up, you will lose some information that will create problem at the end. So the first message, the reason why I say we do not have solved anything, is that we need a top-down approach. We need bottom-up and top-down, otherwise you go into all kinds of trouble. As often as you miss something, for instance here, two small folds have not been detected because they were prone during the skeletonization process. If it's important, you will never find them. You have to go back to the data. So this is not an easy journey. And also, we need some kind of multi-scale representation. For instance, if you remember my story of the superior frontal sulcus, the standard way of defining this fold here, we think that there are smaller entities inside, so you have to go in the wall of the fold to see some variation of curvature. So there's all kind of way to define this representation, and it's not easy to choose. Another analogy that will help me to explain you what we are trying to do for years is the analogy with the handwritten recognition. There's something very similar here, in that most of the methods split the text into pieces supposed to correspond to words, and sometimes they do mistake. But there is a priori knowledge that is very important behind, which is the alphabet. And for years and years, we are trying to find if there is an alphabet behind the folding patterns. The idea that there could be some entities that are atoms, entity, elementary entity that cannot be split and exist in all the brains. And this could be the right roadmap to create the models. And the neurosurgeon I'm working with has proposed 15 years ago now a map of these entities that he called Sulcal Route, that according to him are the first places the cortex is folding. And according to him, his browsing of the biology literature, he thinks even that the chronology of apparition of these folds is very similar across them. And what happened is that during the following of the folding process, these Sulcal Routes merge with each other. And statistically, there are some patterns of merging very frequent. For instance, these four Sulcal Routes, green, red, usually merge to give the superior temporal sulcus. But sometimes this does not happen. Or even worse, one of these Sulcal Routes could merge with the Sulcal Route of another fold, leading to a kind of monstrous brain. Not monstrous because it's pathological, but just because you cannot read it with the standard approach. This idea is also stemming that the talk yesterday afternoon was very interesting because according to this point of view, the bottom of the folds at adult stage correspond to these roots, which means that they are the landmarks. And maybe, in fact, the place where you see the fold from outside could not be stable in terms of architecture. This is just hypothesis, nothing is proven there. So we really believe that the bottom is maybe the most important place to look at when you are looking for models. And the neurosurgeon is going even further. He thinks that these Sulcal Routes, for some reason that are beyond, I don't have time to talk about it, they are organized in parallel and meridian. And the idea is that you have two directions in the brain that are related to architecture, architectomy. One direction turning around here, the Sulcal Valley, is the parallel, and the orthogonal direction is meridian. And the idea that the folding process, the dynamic of this stuff is chaotic, just means that you have some roots that are this kind of cross, that are the beginning of the folding, and after that, you can have some merge either in the horizontal direction or in the vertical direction. And this is where you go into some trouble. Sometimes some brains are very weird just because, for some reason that we don't know, the folding pattern that was preferential changed at 90 degrees compared to the standard one. Of course, we are trying to prove this. It's very difficult. So we fight for years to have access to the folding process. So we work for a long time on multinatal imaging here. So you can reconstruct this stuff. More recently, we work on premature brains, and you can see all kind of stuff. And what we are trying to do is to simulate backward, in fact, the folding process, to see from adult brains where are the elementary places where the brain folds itself. And I will show you just a very simple experiment explaining how we do. Here what you see is the surface of an adult inflated with the mean curvature on it, and we apply a geodesic equation to this stuff. And if you look at this part here, that is this sulcus I'm talking about, the supertemporal sulcus, if you're lucky and not too far from the screen, you will see during the smoothing process, four places that stay where the curvature is higher that may correspond to these Sulcal Routes, and we find that in a lot of brains.
So where are the four places here?
I will try to trigger it again. You see here four black spots that seems to be the place where the curvature was the highest. Okay, I'm sorry. I should have
some other four black spots on there.
Yeah.
Okay.
Maybe I should not have done that. And of course, you can develop some coordinate system using these Sulcal Routes. I will not spend too much time on that. I'm late. And the conclusion of my talk, just to show you all the other directions, where the situation is completely the same. Fiber bundle. We don't have model. We just know the highways of the roadmap of the brain, and we don't even know where are the exit of the highways. So of course, you know diffusion imaging. It's so advertised. Nowadays, it's no more diffusion tensor imaging. People should forget about that. Now it's really diffusion imaging because it's kind of Russian doll images where in each voxel you have a new 3D image that is supposed to be the likelihood of having a fiber in each orientation. And it means that in each voxel you have to solve first a local inverse problem that is going from diffusion data to this likelihood. There's a lot of models, a lot of work on that. It's very difficult, but it's very important. And after that, you have a global inverse problem, which aims at overcoming the fact that there are some areas where there's too many crossing and you cannot track the bundle. So for instance, you can use what we call a spaghetti plate model, use the fact that this bundle has no curvature to solve the problem there. And you get track in all the brands, and after that, you have to find a model. So for instance, you can cluster the tracks according to different similarities, getting this kind of nice color images made up of bundles. And after that, you will try to find bundles that you find in older brands or in family of brands. So it's really the same kind of problem. How to cluster this track, how to develop a graph matching method, a model inference approach dealing with that. Connectivity, the same story. I told you that the main way to split the cortex into pieces is to use connectivity, and now we have connectivity. We have, for instance, if we take one gyrus and we trigger some tracking process from this gyrus, we get all this stuff, and it means that for each voxel of the gyrus, you can have a kind of vector of connectivity, for instance, to other gyri. We do that to simplify the situation compared to what, for instance, is done in Oxford, where you have connectivity to all the points in the brain. And after that, you can perform any kind of non-supervised clustering approach to split the brain into pieces. I will skip that. And for instance, if you want to look at the result, of course, you will get a different result in each individual because this is non-supervised, and there's a lot of variability, a lot of mistake in the tracking. And here, you have the problem is that, for instance, here, if I use a simple color code, which is just corresponding to the color of the parcelization in Jari, you have two brains where you get the same, and here, you get something else. It just means that we really have to do some kind of matching across these areas, because what happens is that these areas is connected to two Jari, and sometimes it's a bit more to one, sometimes it's a bit more to the other one. So, for instance, you can develop a graph matching process based on, I don't know, some similarity measure between using, for instance, divergence, Q-backlider divergence to compare, in fact, this probability of a connection to different Jari. I'm late, I'm trying to finish. And to conclude, I would say, we are not saying that the only way is structural. For instance, if you want to use this connectivity stuff another way because it's very complicated and you don't trust too much this bundle tracking, clustering and stuff, you can, for instance, compute for the cortical surface, the mesh of the surface, a connectivity matrix. And you can try to find surface matching process trying to match, in fact, this connectivity matrix. It's just the beginning of the story. But if you remember all this period where people like Paul or me try to match the brain according to the faults, there's still a big problem behind that, is that we don't know which are the faults that are really architectural landmarks. When you talk about connectivity, everybody agreed we should match connectivity. So this is really something that will maybe change the alignment problem. And my conclusion is that I'm no more in the lab Paul was talking about, the institution I'm belonging to, which is surprisingly the French Atomic Energy Commission. Think that now the frame of neural imaging is in a kind of phase transition where we can no more think that neural imaging is a field with labs having their scanners doing their business. Now maybe there's some place for bigger machines, a bit like what happened in high energy physics in the old time. So we have created a new center which is dedicated to develop very high field scanners, and that is think as an international center where each of you can apply to come to do some experiment.
Where is it?
It's in the suburb of Paris. The construction has been finished at the end of last year. Each of these arches is for a big machine. And here is the most impressive massive machine that should be done during the last 3-4 years, or the next 3-4 years. So it's a 12 Tesla magnet for humans. Of course, we are looking for some volunteer to do that. And the reason why we are doing that is that we have great physicists. It's a physicist institution. It's the people who are doing, for instance, the magnet of the CERN, the energy physics institution of Europe, and also the magnet of the tokamak of the ITER project for fusion. So this is the machine they are building now, based on all kinds of new technology. And what we think is that we will reach a new kind of spatial resolution, allowing to trigger new kind of similar problems related to the cortical layers and this kind of thing. And for people who want to play with the software, the artificial neural anatomies, you can download it from here with all kinds of other stuff distributed by teams in France.